This is AVXL episode 24, recorded August 31st, 2016.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. All right, I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content, no matter what your budget is. Oh my goodness, micro LEDs, or LEDs, I guess we call them. Micro LEDs. I like that, though.
Tiny lights.
Micro LEDs. Oh, my goodness. 4K for computers from Sony. Dolby Atmos soundbars from Samsung. And a whole bunch of conversations about Calman. And so much more coming up in this episode, including perhaps the weirdest reissue of Labor Day week for the Blu-ray content.
It's a limited selection.
Oh my goodness, it's a peculiar selection. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
And we're going to try to make sure the rest of the show doesn't ramble quite as much as that normally brief discussion of what's coming up on the show. It's right before Labor Day weekend. And as always, we want to remind you that askatavxl.com is the best email to reach us with your questions about home theater and headphones and
heck yeah,
HD and 4K and UHD and Atmos and Mayhem and DTS. And
how to, I don't know, invigorate your senses.
Hey,
one way or the other.
We want your entertainment experience to be full of awesome. Speaking of which, I got to get myself back on the Sonos mailing list because I found out a couple days ago that... when the news blew up on the internet is that Sonos is finally going to give Spotify control over Sonos, the household audio system, the wireless audio system. Spotify control is going to be available in October if you have the Spotify beta, kind of the early adopters program. And they're going to do integration with Alexa. Alexa, buy something expensive.
That idea. I mean, if you're going to have a device sitting in your house that's listening for commands... integrate that into everything. Open that up.
Well, just being able to, because, you know, Sonos has made leaps in, I mean, part of the reason Sonos is so popular is because their software, the control software, is so much better than most of what's out there. And they've kept the availability and the stability of the units. Like, they redesigned the 5, but the majority of their products have been out for a long time, and they don't change it every 6 months or 6 years, and everything's still compatible.
And speaking of that Sonos love for Spotify, they just added the service, actually. You can now stream that content starting, I think, yesterday or the day before. So
no, Spotify, you've been able to use Spotify for a long time. You have to like open up the app, search, and then select. You have to sign it up.
It wasn't as tightly integrated.
Yeah, well, it's been pretty tightly integrated for a while. We've been using it for quite some time.
There were the stories in places like The Verge and stuff that says, hey, you are not stuck with the Sonos controller app anymore.
Well, that's just it. You used to. What happened though is you could use the Sonos app to access Spotify, but you could not use the Spotify access to play music through your Sonos speakers. So in October, you'll be able to use the Spotify app to send music to your Sonos speakers, which if you're a Spotify/Sonos user, makes sense as something that you desperately want. If you don't use Spotify and Sonos, probably won't make no sense.
Gotcha.
And Shannon, of course, was bouncing around with joy, finding out that she'd finally be able to say, Alexa, play whatever on Sonos, Sonos living room.
I will say for the streaming services, if you are kind of an audiophile of some, if you can hear the difference between compressed versus the more lossless formats, I would suggest spending the money for the monthly fee where you can get the higher quality streams. And both Pandora through Pandora One and Spotify through their premium service both offer those.
Spotify Premium is $10 a month. It bumps you up to a 300K stream. And it is
I really do appreciate it. So I tend to, if I'm going to be using those services a lot, I'll pay that little extra.
And there's no ads in Spotify Premium.
Bonus.
So yeah, no, I am a huge fan of Spotify Premium. It is an excellent investment. I'm trying to remember if they use Ogg Vorbis still for Spotify.
Ogg, I have done some sweet compressed audio using that open format, and I really appreciate those types of formats.
Oh my goodness!
No messing around with licensing or, although I think Fraunhofer's made MP3. You can encode an MP3 for free if you want. Whatever you want for free if you really want to. So.
Oh, Spotify uses, according to the latest article I found on support.spotify.com, 320K kilobits per second is available to premium subscribers.
I'm telling you, My ears did appreciate it.
Yeah, no, it's a huge difference. Like, they normally on a phone, it'll do like 96K, which is
why I have really 60 mediocre. Plus gigs of music lossless on my phone. So I don't have to do anything but say local only. No data services, yeah. Please.
Well, the trick is to go into the library, go to settings, go to streaming quality, and then set extreme.
That feels really good after you've paid for the service and can make that switch flip. You will, your ears will appreciate it.
Yes.
That's all I'm going to say about that.
Oh, but there's so much more to say. We could go on like this for hours.
Yes, we could.
Oh, man. Speaking of next year, if you remember, we talked last episode about Intel being all excited about the 4K decoding being built into the Kaby Lake chips.
I thought about that a little bit. You know, video decoding on a CPU, even in the GPU built into a CPU, it had better be able to do that well, because it's like, and it better, I mean, handling a single stream.
Well, part of their point was like, you know, why do this with the main CPU when you can offload that to a dedicated processor
that's
much more efficient? But HD Guru reports that Sony Home Pictures Entertainment and Intel Corporation are releasing the Sony Ultra 4K movie streaming service on computers with Intel 7 Gen Core processors in the first quarter of 2017. And there's going to be a 48-hour rental option, not just purchases as well. So CES.
I have Sony's 4K streaming product that I haven't fired up in a while, but that was the first device I had that was delivering 4K downloaded content, saved to a local hard drive, and it had streaming options too. But generally, you were downloading enough of it to buffer image quality and sound quality. You were getting lossless audio tracks for the movies and superb 4K. And if this is going to bring, hopefully, HDR and wide color gamut as well,
right,
through that content. Awesome. And the only downside I will say to all of Sony's 4K offerings so far is pricing. It is just ridiculously expensive for what it is. This is in no way going to compete with anything like a Netflix or anybody, Amazon for that matter. If they could really bring even the rental pricing for the content was expensive. So, and how many people are going to pay, like, say, $35 for a movie to own it on a hard drive locked device? Although, in this case, with streaming through PC devices, that's at least they're opening up that platform, so you don't need to buy specific hardware to get that content in your home. You could use, say, like a home theater PC or any of these devices that will be 4K ready on those Intel chips. So that's cool. I like that. I like seeing more options for streaming a single service like that rather than just a dedicated hardware box. Something you could do it yourself right there for some 4K entertainment. I kind of dig it.
Goodness. Samsung's Dolby Atmos soundbars, the ones they were showing off at CES, are finally on sale. Really nice write-up and review up on TechRadar. The HW K950 is $1,500. It's a soundbar, a wireless subwoofer, and rear surrounds, also wireless. Something like 16 drivers in that, each with its own amp and a 5.1.4 configuration, so it's both front and rear on the Atmos. TechRadar review, I think, said that the DTS is currently stereo only, which I thought was kind of weird.
I had a chance to preview this in a controlled environment at a Samsung facility, and it was delivering some of those height channel effects that you would associate with an Atmos system, that 3D audio.
Right.
And this was using speakers on the ground that were up firing at the ceiling. And it sounded pretty good, although this was, I will criticize one thing. The demo material was terrible, but the sound quality, I have to say, was pretty good. So I'll be curious to spend a little bit more time with that, but I'm not as much of a soundbar person, although I use them a lot, I will admit. I always think it's like, soundbar is like my last option, but in a lot of cases, it's just the easiest, most convenient way to get good audio quickly into an environment without taking up a lot of space or hassle.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. I like it, I like it, I like it.
I like it. Oh, my goodness. We got a viewer question from Steven, who writes in, with this, and he links to a MacRumors.com article, Apple OLED versus LCD versus micro LED plans just being talked about. Could you explain what micro LED is and how it works? Thanks, Steven. So micro LED is a flat panel display tech, and I'm going to quote Wikipedia here. As the name implies, MLED displays consist of arrays of microscopic LEDs forming the individual pixel elements. Compared to the widespread LCD technology, MLED offers far greater contrast, much faster response times, and would use less energy, which makes it sound a lot like OLED.
In a sense. But yeah, literally a surface covered with very tiny RGB LEDs, red, red, green, blue.
Doesn't seem to be a particular thing for, you know, 55, 60, 65 inch, 40 inch. You know, it's kind of like early days of OLED where you were seeing it in little tiny displays.
A couple of years ago at CES, Sony had a very amazing looking prototype of this very technology. And they were showing it off as like, here's one way we could do, you know, an OLED competitor or something that can deliver greater brightness than current OLED TVs, yet still maintain that perfect black level, viewing angle, everything else you associate with OLED.
Apparently difficult to produce.
You think about it. That's a lot of OLEDs. If you're talking an 8 million subpixel 4K display, that's a lot of surface placement for these materials. And to do that accurately and quickly, and I'm more curious about the production and see if anything's changed since the last time I saw it. Hopefully they're not simply individually placing these RGB LEDs, because what machine is doing this? Hopefully it's doing a row at a time or something like that. And you also, because of, depending on the screen size, at a specific resolution, the pixel size will change.
Right.
So likely, if a display is made with this technology, it's only going to be available in a couple of sizes. And I have yet to see what the effective power consumption would be. Yeah, LEDs are efficient, but when you start talking, you know, 4-8 million of them all in series. And yeah, that could easily exceed, and let alone what TVs do in HDR modes right now, as far as power consumption goes. That's something else we could talk about at some point. But yeah, I have seen this display. It was as impressive as anything I've ever seen. And it was actually in a dimly lit environment, displaying very saturated color work. And I've seen Sony's professional OLED monitors, and it really reminded me of, and those are by far the most beautiful thing I've seen in the last year or so.
Right.
And it should be for the cost, but that LED prototype, that micro LED
prototype.
You can
buy a new car or a Sony professional monitor.
You better be making some money to deserve this, or to be putting this monitor to good use or something like that. So, but yeah, I don't see those coming anytime soon, and it's just the challenge of scaling it to any particular size. But the concept is solid. The potential is there, and I would like to see somebody actually put that out for sale to see what they got the cost to.
Yeah, I mean, so part of the article that Stephen linked to on Mac Rumors is pointing out, so Apple bought a micro LED company back in 2014, Luxview Technology. Like, I think they had been out, they raised like $25 million in 2013 and were bought by Apple in 2014. You know, last year, Apple opened up a secret laboratory in Taiwan, you know, basically to develop future iOS device displays. They poached a bunch of people from AU Optronics and Qualcomm's Sol-Link.
Because if everyone, the mobile manufacturers want to go to OLED displays generally.
Right.
And they are now the most popular display type used in mobile phones. They've surpassed what LCDs are being, or how many LCDs are being used. The thing is on when you get to these smaller displays with the similar resolution as a big TV, you're talking even tinier LEDs, then that would be even more of a challenge to manufacture. And if Samsung is the number one supplier of these OLED panels for mobile devices, and they control over 90% of that market.
Yeah.
So if Apple can't get it, like we've talked about, you've mentioned this before, if Apple can't get enough of a particular panel technology for a new product, then they have to look around at other stuff. So,
and I think that's a lot of what's probably going on here, because, you know, the only thing that Apple's currently using OLED displays on is the watch, which hasn't been a particularly huge hit for them, but, you know, hopefully with the new watch coming out in theory this fall, the watch that they should have released next year. Sorry, it's just, it's
no. I 100% agree.
You know, the
I'm not a first adopter on any of those new things, but the second one does appeal to me more than the first one. So.
Well, you were part of the Kickstarter for the Pebble.
Oh, man, it's, you know, it still works, still gets 5 to 6 days of battery life per charge, and I appreciate that convenience of having I don't have to have my phone out in my hand to, you know, quick read a text or, you know, say, yes, I've seen this. Or for that aspect of it, I find very useful. I have so many friends, though, who wear like Fitbits or some sort of health monitoring product. And I'm not into wearing multiple anything if I don't have to. So if I could get it all incorporated into my smartwatch, I think that would be as appealing as anything. So,
but we were talking about micro LEDs.
No, that's true. Yeah, sweet display tech.
You know, if
I've seen the prototypes.
If Apple can figure out a way to own this technology and be the primary producer of this technology, and more importantly, not have to pay Samsung or LG or anybody else for OLED. You know, that's above and beyond the fact that a lot of analysts think that micro LED could be disruptive. Which is,
Samsung's already put investments in things like using quantum dots as emissive displays, and they're looking at everything like everyone else is. So it's a great time. But I will say, speaking of OLED, I did a terrific calibration of one recently. It came out really well. I was really happy with that. After doing the same, you do the same model TV like a dozen times. Eventually, you get all the little tricks and stuff.
You were finding the whole OLED calibration thing, I think I feel comfortable in saying, emotionally traumatizing.
It depends. I've run into issues where somebody had a bad source device or something wasn't set up right. So everything's right on the TV, but then whatever was connected to it wasn't configured properly. And that can cause some headaches and things like that. But just a reminder, check your stuff that's connected and make sure that's also configured right.
Garbage in, garbage out, people.
Yeah.
Mark writes, ask@avxl.com. Hi, Robert and Patrick. In episode 17, you talked about the Calman Mobile Forge app, but Robert didn't have much experience with it. I was wondering if you have any new information about this for those of us that need help with adjusting color settings but don't have access to a calibration service and need more help than a calibration disc can provide. My new 65-inch Vizio has good picture overall, but it is way too warm. Red is oversaturated. White looks like pee. That's
not
pretty
good.
Yellow. Changing the color temperature preset to cool is better, but pink tones around the eyes or mouth become berry colored. Love the shows. Keep up the good work. Thanks, Dr. M.
Dr. M is making good observations. Often when you switch the color temperature up to that cooler preset, that makes white appear whiter, but that additional blue can sometimes bring in some magenta and other things and really tweak your skin tones. And yeah, that's where you can eyeball a white balance a little bit, but that's where it's really nice to have an app. And that Mobile Forge app is for iOS, Android, and probably something else I can't think of. That's a free app you can download that will take a device like an Amazon Fire TV and make that the signal generator. Then it'll produce the colored patterns, the grayscales, things like that, that you can then use, say, either Calman's free color checker software to do basic analysis, or you can step up to a licensed platform and some of their more advanced software. Either way, you're going to need a meter no matter what, and you need some hardware, and you're going to need a PC to run that on, or a MacBook or something. And in that case, it works pretty darn well, actually. I've gone through the Home Express workflow that will be included with Calman products, like their $99 Home Express package that included the C3 meter and a year of the software access. And so for that $99, you're getting that C3 meter, and that would give you the meter plus the Home Express package, which I found the color checker software that's free is really kind of limited in terms of, it'll do an analysis and give you a good overview of the current performance of your monitor, but it doesn't really give you the direct A-B comparison stuff to make adjustments with. It's more to see like, hey, am I on target or could I make improvements? Sure. And then I have to go forward and find something like Home Express. Looking through the Home Express workflow, though, it's decent. It includes getting the brightness set properly, a clipping check so you're not setting your contrast too high, and it takes you through these in order of the best way to do it. The next step would be something like adjusting your color temperature and what gamma preset to use, effectively going through the different presets, doing a quick measurement and saying, okay, that one's closest to target. The last two parts would be a color space check that just says make sure you're not setting it in the crazy ultra-wide mode for your regular HD content. And then a two-point white balance setup. So effectively, the only things I really see missing there are any kind of color management system analysis or setup, a full range white balance analysis and setup, and including, you know, measuring like 10 or 20 steps from 0 to 100, a full-blown color checker and saturation sweeps. Although you could just repurpose the color checker app. That's free anyway. Just load that up. But those saturation sweeps I like a lot because it just plots the primaries and secondaries from usually like 20% saturation levels, so 20, 40, 60, 80, 100. And then, because a lot of TVs do weird things at the very extremes of saturation, but you want to make sure the 60, 70, 80% color levels are, or the saturation levels are right on target. Because that's there's more content within those levels than it's going to be out at 100%, where things can get odd. But otherwise, there are plenty of other software options, too, once you have pretty much any common meter out there. And that includes projects like HCFR and DisplayCal and a few others. I'll be sure to link to all that stuff for you. And there's a terrific section over on the AVS forum as well for just calibration, be it DIY or more professional. Tons of people. Everyone's got every TV they're talking about, so you can find your specific model and get some direct feedback from the people actually, you know, making adjustments and sharing their results. And for that, So just be aware of the specific limitations of what a $99 package can do. It's gonna be better than any disc, especially with that white balance setup. It only gives you the 2 points. And I'll be honest with you, if you're going back and forth on those 2 points and you're making adjustments on one and it's screwing up the other, you can try to get a good balance there. But the goal overall is to try to adjust the controls as little as possible, if possible. If possible. The less tweaking you have to do generally, the less chance you're going to have of negatively affecting the picture. And if you only had to pick the higher, the bright or the dark grays to adjust the bright grays, get those right on target. That's generally that will generally do the most good.
Adjust the bright.
If you can't do both, do those bright grays because your eye is a little more sensitive to that color and that brightness level and those things compared to the darker end. Although I stare at shadows a lot, so I'm real sensitive to when colors shift in the darker grays. So.
Sounds so dark when you say it like that. I stare at shadows a lot.
I want to see it as the artist intended. you mean
shadows when you're evaluating video?
Because I'm still having flashbacks to that. I'm not even going to talk about the Olympics. Just that one 4K streaming video, though, of the swimming event and how different it was with the automatic settings on two HDR TVs. Mm-hmm. And clearly one was a little more accurate than the other, but...
It was kind of staggering how different the pool colors were.
Without a doubt. And, yeah, be aware that getting into HDR setup, though, everything I've talked about up to this point is just for HD setup, which is important. That's everything from your game console to your broadcast television to your streaming content. Those same settings apply to all of that. But when you get into HDR, then you're talking about meters that have to be good up to a certain brightness level, usually very bright, as well as being able to enable those modes within the display device. And that's a whole other round of hardware and headaches that probably go above and beyond this conversation at the time being. But I would love to get into that. It's interesting. We're in the wild west of calibration, so to speak, right there. But I see more better things every day in terms of the ability to control it, measure it, and figure out where it's going.
Speaking of more better things, and we were talking about Sonos earlier, it sounds like Riva has your favorite Bluetooth speaker company. They do some very nice Bluetooth speakers.
No complaints about their hardware.
Is the Wand series, is that going to be a whole house like Wi-Fi system, or is it?
Yeah, baby. They just announced this. They have. Mm-hmm. They're saying they're having two sizes in their series. They have the Arena and the Festival models. The Arena being the smaller, more compact one with three of their ADX drivers and three passive radiators. And then I think what we previewed actually back in CES was in a private meeting room with this company. They showed off the prototype for their Festival model that's coming out that incorporates six of their sweet ADX drivers plus four passive radiators. And what they really hammered in to us at this particular demo was they are as fidelity-centric as anyone in terms of making a box that produces good sound quality, as accurate reproduction as you can do with what you're given. But on top of that, this box, they just wanted to make it compatible with everything from Wi-Fi streaming, Spotify, AirPlay, DLNA, Bluetooth, Google Cast Ready, lossless support, every stupid file you want to throw at this thing, it'll probably deal with it just fine. So, but the sound quality again, when they, and this was with prototype hardware, it was pretty final, but they were still, you know, final tweaking the stuff we listened to. But I have to say, the Festival model will definitely fill a room with good sounding audio. And I'm looking forward to actually getting the retail package in hand because it's always for the money, it's some of the best audio gear I've heard in that space.
Yeah.
So it's as good as anyone's I've heard. So.
It's done a write-up with this on Sound and Vision. The Riva Wand 100, the Wand 300.
Oh.
Yeah.
I think those were the old names.
Well.
Maybe not. Maybe that's like the model number or something too. So. But the arena and the festival.
I also need to hear the new, I got to hear the new Play 5. Or no, I should say the Man, if I had a brain, I'd be a useful human being. The
if I know, only had a...
No. That's pretty much where I'm at. The Play 5 is the new one. I was right. The
Sonos?
Yeah, they redesigned the 5. The
yeah.
Big one, the big speaker. It's been interesting listening to that because I was playing around with on Tech Thing this week. I finally got to review Kef's Egg speakers.
Oh yeah,
which are fantastic. It's
those are the speakers I would like on my desk.
Yeah,
you know, if I'm not gonna have the like the LS
when the biggest or something. Yeah, well, so like the LS50s. It's so the Egg are kind of like the little brother of the 300s, which are the little brother of the LS50s, which are the little brother of the Blade, which are the little brother of the Muon. And as you go through that, this the Uni-Q technology where they basically put a tweeter in the center of a sort of mid-range driver to so all of the levels of audio, all of the octaves of audio that you use for localization and stuff, you know, from the sort of vocals all the way up through the sparkly high-end stuff that really helps your ear cue into where audio is coming from or localize, you know, the location of instruments or stuff when you're talking about a stereo recording or playing back, for that matter, a movie in stereo. By putting the tweeter dead center in the middle of the mid-range, and I assure you it is much more sophisticated than the car stereo speaker from 1986 that you're thinking of right now, because they literally the entire cone moves, but the center of the cone is the tweeter that does not move, and then they do a what they call their tangerine waveguide. But the end result is that you have this relatively huge sweet spot, and you know, there's not like, it's not one of those things where you have to be sitting the right, the dead center perfect spot to get sort of a decent stereo effect. Fantastic vocals, fantastic highs, shocking amount of bass. You know, they rated it like 80 hertz, I want to say negative 3 dB. But the reality is you're still getting stuff down to about 50 hertz and probably about 5 dB down. You know, so, you know, I'm listening against Rage Against the Machine or the Red Hot Chili Peppers, you know,
nice.
And like, it's not shaking my chest because there's no sub bass. There's nothing between 20 and 40 hertz, the stuff you feel.
Yeah.
But they also thoughtfully enough put a subwoofer output. So if you want to add a subwoofer, you can just use the subwoofer out. But it does Bluetooth audio, DTS audio. You can do an optical input from your television. You can do plug it to your computer and do USB audio. There's a 96 K 24-bit DAC.
I still
want to
buy one of those $100 monoprice subs. Just to
have it around. I wanted to buy one during the 20. They had a 20% off sale, but they were sold out on them. They also have a monoprice.
The new reference sub.
Yeah,
the monoprice $100.
Look, if
can you beat that?
Well, I'll be honest with you.
Some can, most definitely.
You know, if Brent Butterworth and Jeff Morrison are saying that, you know, that $108 subwoofer.
That was awesome.
From Monoprice is pretty badass, and I assure you it's pretty badass.
I'm just telling you, that's just the...
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no reason not to have a sub in the mix.
Yeah.
If cost is the issue.
Oh, my goodness. There is no reason. Yeah, it'd be fun to put that into this. The Kef speakers, these Eggs, cost $500.
Yeah, that's the thing, too.
Well, if you think about it, if you bought a pair of LS50s, which are legendary... you know, A, legendary, and B, will require you to buy an amplifier and a source, then suddenly you're looking, I'm thinking of like, you know, $2,500 worth of speaker and amplifier is suddenly contained in this little unit that I can plug in.
Suddenly the Egg is looking way more attractive.
Yeah, I mean, right now my computer desktop speakers are a pair of B&W 601s with the amp camp amps strapped to them, and you know, I'm
so
alternating
divine.
Between the AudioQuest Dragonfly, the Emotiva Little Ego, and the output from my Asus motherboard, which is pretty fantastic. They did a really nice job with the last round of the motherboards from Asus, but yeah, That was pretty amusing. Blu-ray releases, kind of a classic Labor Day weekend.
Happy holiday, everyone.
Happy holiday, everyone.
If you're here in the U.S. and you get a day off, enjoy.
Yeah, I think the two highlights are probably Money Monster, which doesn't have the best reviews. It's been out on iTunes, and I assume...
I'm not sure if I've ever heard of that.
Well, it's...
Money Monster?
Money Monster. I'm surprised because, you know, this screams Robert Heron to me.
I have bookmarked my local Dolby Cinema theater, the one screen within 100 miles of me.
I don't even remember this being in theaters, but Jodie Foster's the director. George Clooney stars as the host of the sort of loudmouth screaming host of a finance
program.
Yeah. Julia Roberts is his producer.
Interesting.
And somebody basically comes onto the set with a gun who's very upset about losing money.
That happens.
Not a particularly popular movie in terms of IMDb ratings or
Rotten Tomatoes ratings. Risk is yours to assume.
Yeah.
Jim Cramer, Mad Money.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. This is like 57% on the tomato meter.
Aww.
But, you know, it's George Clooney and Julia Roberts. I mean, how could you go wrong? Okay. Yeah. You can go really wrong. Roadhouse has been re-released.
More Swayze. There you go. That's
the timeless classic.
That's the fix I needed right there to get away from whatever that money thing was you just mentioned.
The Karate Kid Part 3, the next Karate Kid.
Those never happened.
Hey, you know what? Hilary Swank and Pat Morita. How can you go wrong with that in the next Karate Kid? Okay. Like I said,
it's a weird week.
Now You See Me, Now You Don't, or Now You See Me 2. Probably, I think the best picks would be coming out this weekend. This week. Man, The Iron Giant. Brad Bird's.
Good one.
Oh, my goodness.
Good movie.
It is animation.
Oh, that's cool.
It is Brad Bird kind of did his own interpretation of a Ted Hughes book. Ted Hughes, extraordinary English writer. If you don't remember who Brad Bird is, you might know him from, The Incredibles. Who else? I mean, he worked on he did some Simpsons stuff. He did The Incredibles. He did
a fine animated storyteller.
Yeah,
I'm digging it.
Yeah, no, it's. I'm just laughing because I'm sort of looking at the links up here, and I realize that I'm on Blu-ray.com and not on IMDb. I was like, there's a bunch of movies here I can't think of the name of. And
I got a couple laying around that I just need to finish. I just ordered The Revenant on UHD Blu-ray for image quality.
Let me know if you ever want to watch that a second time.
Exactly. Probably not. But yeah. I'll note a bunch of scenes, I'm sure, that make for great analysis and viewing for be it HDR or even 4K Blu-ray.
Oh, my goodness. Now I remember now. He wrote Ratatouille. Wrote the original story for Ratatouille.
There's the movie I actually saw. I think I saw that in the theater. And
love Ratatouille.
Enjoyed it. Now, you know what? Yeah. I didn't see it in the theater. I saw it at home.
Oh, and he was the director of Ratatouille. The Iron Giant's Incredible Ratatouille,
like
Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol, Tomorrowland, which I really want to see, which didn't get the best reviews, and The Incredibles 2, which is coming out in 2019.
Oh, that first one was so great.
Yeah, but The Iron Giant was his first, his first animated feature. It's a 9-year-old boy named Hogarth,
Hogarth
becomes friends with an alien robot.
Sweet.
And mayhem ensues. It's awesome. My kids love it. It's really interesting to look at that and then at The Incredibles because they're two such radically different movies.
I'll keep these in the back of my head if I'm needing to entertain some young folk for a couple hours.
My goodness. And from the 80s watch, My Body's Guard is now available on Blu-ray. Apparently, the transfer is not the best. Apparently, it was an older master, and it's very grainy.
It was. That was true film back then.
Yeah,
so.
It was. You know, but if you want to see what Jane of Firefly Fame like when he was 12, which is huge and slightly threatening.
He was 12 in that movie?
No. I'm sure he was
younger.
Like,
much younger. Okay.
When was Adam Baldwin born? How old is Adam Baldwin? 1962, so he would have been 18.
He looks pretty good
in My Bodyguard.
for being a, is he officially a senior citizen now? Does he have his AARP card? He might.
No, he's getting close.
I think he
does.
He's close.
Yeah. Well, it's no.
Wait, they get that at 50 or 55. I forget. If it's 50, he's definitely got it.
I always thought it was like 62, but you know.
I'm signing up the day I turn 50. I want that card now.
Just bar your mom's, right?
Hand it over.
Oh, my goodness.
Jane, I actually just finished rewatching Firefly again before they pulled it from Netflix, which as soon as people are like, oh, Firefly's on Netflix, I go, it was. It comes and goes for a variety of reasons. So.
Mostly about whether or not they want to pay money, but it's good. I mean, the series holds up. It's always amazing.
Firefly?
Yeah.
I think so. There are a couple. I think that very last episode, too, in the series, I think it was episode 14, was one of my favorite things in any sci-fi. It was just one of the, it was an epic episode.
Yeah.
It was a bounty hunter episode where a bounty hunter takes over the ship, and just the dialogue alone was just perfect.
And yeah, just no, something. Just as soon as they, it's funny.
It was Joss Whedon's favorite episode that he did, too, and it really kind of showed. And
that's,
anyway,
well,
that
that's, I mean, that's frustrating, right? Because Fox, you know, didn't like it. Just because you made us billions of dollars with Buffy the Vampire Slayer and were a huge cultural phenomenon doesn't mean you know what you're doing, Joss. You might remember him as the person who brought the Avengers together.
I will say, though, Firefly is going to be one of those things where you shouldn't tell anyone if they know nothing about it. Don't tell them that there's only one season. It'll just you get them hooked. It's like, well, I don't mean to tell you this, but it's that was it. And, oh, wait, you can watch the movie when you're done and kind of have some closure.
Oh, my goodness.
And the books and other stuff, but. There is more to that. If they're going to bring any damn sci-fi back, that had better be on somebody's short list, and I would love to see that. But
yeah, I don't know. I still don't understand how Fox made. I mean, Fox made Whedon basically create a new opening episode, post them out of order. I mean, this is the guy. I mean, you know, I mean, Dollhouse. Even my wife can't defend Dollhouse. But you know, when you start realizing this guy, like. You know, he wrote a couple episodes of Roseanne, a couple episodes of Parenthood. He wrote the original Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie.
Gotta get your credits.
Oh, yeah. Then he wrote, you know, one of the versions of Toy Story. We won't recommend that. We won't mention that he was involved in the screenplay for Titan A.E. And if you're a fan, I'm sorry. But then Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Firefly, Angel, Serenity, Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, which is fantastic. If you've never seen it, they basically they made that during the last strike in Hollywood.
There's a trivia question related to Serenity that I just, it's at the top of my head. What is it? Is it the first, was it the first
Cabin in the Woods
Blu-ray,
which came out right before the Avengers? Oh my goodness, so much good stuff. So much good stuff.
There's some kind of a cool piece of trivia related to that Serenity disc. It was a test case for either the new color standard
for
DCI. It was one of the first commercial presentations of DCI color. God, now it's going to bug me.
That's going to bug you.
The great googly question I will submit.
Well, he's looking up that googly question. Man, I'm trying to think what else I'm playing around with this week. I finally got in the entry level, the $200 version of the Amplify standard. That's the mesh networking system. It's a competitor to Eero. That's the $200 version. So for slightly more than you'll pay for an incredibly expensive router, you get the Amplify base station and the two mesh points. Now it's 2x2 MIMO AC, not 3x3 like the HD version, and it's
that'd be fine for
a little less powerful
household.
I'll be curious because I'm going to look at it in my house, which is like 1,100 square feet and made out of plaster that kills RF, and then I'm also going to compare it like I did with the HD here in the warehouse, which is 5,000 square feet.
I've been in so many homes that shove the access point in some spare bedroom and close the door, and it just screws up signaling throughout the house, and then you just...
That's what's interesting. Is essentially, it creates its own, you know, network.
Skips a lot of that hassle.
Yeah, it works like a corporate network or a corporate networking, you know, with essentially functions like it has multiple base stations. Logitech's Pop Home Switch, got that in for review, which is kind of a cousin to the Harmony remotes, except that they basically took like the chain multiple things together. You know, in your Harmony remote mode, except that
very
it's like a little switch.
That's effectively one of the things Harmony was kind of missing.
A button,
was,
if you will.
A button. A fully programmable button like that. Hey, I guess this. I was actually kind of close. Serenity was... Dun-da-da-dun! Is used by Universal Pictures to test the workflow required to create a DCP, effectively the one of the 2K intermediate files that when they were testing the DCI specification. So there's a little wackiness afoot with that. There might be a little extra special. A few more eyes definitely looked at that video before it left the mastering suite, so to speak. So cool. But yeah, after dealing with some of my friends' Wi-Fi issues, I was doing everything, including and up to that what is it, the Wave Surfer mod you can do for an antenna where you just take a piece of foil and put it on the template that's curved and you can add a little directionality to the antenna output and input. And that actually helped a lot, I have to say. We have that whole DLTV video where I was completely skeptical. And then you whipped it out and it actually worked. And then... So I put that to good use this weekend, but looking at something like Amplify that makes it so simple to create that mesh network, man, it's just...
Yeah, it's an interesting product. Ubiquiti started what they call Ubiquiti Labs, which is taking Ubiquiti, the giant wireless networking company, and doing some consumer-facing products.
The only thing I'd like to see different on that would be one that does the networking over the power line. And that way, then, it could use each of those mesh points without doing a wireless link to that first. And then, granted, you're using separate channels and everything for all of it, but there's something elegant, I think, about power line networking, especially when you go to these endpoints where you can just, anywhere you plug it into an outlet, then it would become an access
as long,
point.
I mean, as long as your house doesn't create issues with that, which...
At my father's place, where I was visiting recently, they have one... The power over networking or power line networking is actually extending it, I gotta say, a couple hundred feet. It was ridiculously long run, a ridiculously long run that actually still worked. And I was like, that's the longest I'd seen anyone do that, and it worked out really well. And a mutual friend of ours actually had been hesitating, and I was about to, he wanted to do all hardwired between this rental he's doing in a exterior building. And I'm like, have you even tried power line networking? It generally will work in most cases, and it's just, you know, it's a fraction of the cost for, you know, running cable through the walls and everything. And sure enough, plugged in both ends and it just freaking works. And that's another thing too, there are products out there that will at least provide access points through power line networking, and I've looked at those and they work pretty well, but price is starting around usually 75 to 100 plus bucks depending on what kind of radio system you want, you know, single 2.4 gigahertz or, you know, multi-radio.
More radios. Oh, my goodness.
But anything to help the Wi-Fi situation be consistent around the household is good for us all.
It is. So you've been doing more HDR testing.
Heck yeah. Man, it is endless. And I will say, it is... Every TV has its own set of... challenges and whatnot. Some TVs provide a single control that kind of takes care of all the HDR related settings. Some require individual calibrations and setup for that. I am really looking forward to when all TVs can just do that, make everything HDR for the folks that just need that light output.
Right.
It's like all the TVs I saw last year, I can't think of one that actually offered a mode that would give you HDR brightness in a SDR signal. You always had to put HDR content in to see that super bright detail. So those types of things changing up are always great. And I got to say, I produced one of the finest calibrations on LG's, which one was it? The E6 OLED. And I have to say the grayscale looked so phenomenally good and the color errors were so low. It's just that TV really does calibrate nicely, I will say. That's still a... ain't nothing wrong with the OLED and ain't nothing wrong with that bright ass LCD either. No. Although they, you know, get a little off axis and things change. Oh, here is one thing I want to mention. I always talk about the viewing angles and how great they are with OLED. There is shifting in the picture. It is just not as obvious, perhaps. If you like that beautiful calibrated grayscale I produced on that LG OLED, that's looking at it straight on, as the meter was, as the prime seat in the house was, but I moved a little bit off axis, and you'll see a different shade of gray in each corner then. And that's just something to be aware of. The film that they put on top of that panel does affect off-axis viewing somewhat, especially the grayscale performance. So it is, there is room for improvement there as well, to say. However, when I look at something like an LCD off-axis and you start to notice, you know, the haloing and the glare around, say, like a bright object on a black background, that's where then the per-pixel control of an OLED just wows you the most. And it's something to keep in mind. But I'm just pleased to see 1,000 nits ain't so funny anymore. It's like you got plenty of TVs out there that can hit it. Granted, that's like a premium function for this year, but still. It's just beautiful. And the better coverage for the DCI spec currently used in commercial cinema as we try to move toward Rec 2020 to cover that whole gamut. But just getting the color that Hollywood currently uses into the home, oh.
That would be
just
nice.
Just awesome. Like, it just makes me happy.
You've been playing around with the RGB LED strips.
This was just, I'm interested in LED and lighting technologies and everything anyway, but I was looking at something called those strip tapes you can buy.
Right.
You can buy them in reels.
At one point, Darren had like dozens of them wrapped around the storage racks in the warehouse, so this place would go into full disco mode at the drop of a hat.
And a buddy of ours who was doing a customized bicycle wrapped the entire bike with this tape. It's about a half inch wide, waterproof. The version I was looking at was called 5050. RGB LED tape. The numbers refer to the dimensions of the LED module itself. So 5050 would be 5mm by 5mm. And that, there are some other variants of that. But when you see those four numbers, just realize it's two sets of measurements, length and width. These are RGB LED. There's a red, a blue, and a green LED that you can get this stuff on Amazon, I kid you not, for like 10 cents a foot. Or not, maybe not that cheap, but it was very well priced. But when I tried to find long rolls of it, suddenly the price was just jacked up amazingly. So it's better, I'm finding, at least currently, for most of the sources I'm finding, to buy just the individual strips, which can be about 15 or so feet long. They run off of 12-volt power. I ran everything from a half amp to 3 amps through it on a 15-foot strip. And, yeah, definitely dimmable. You can select colors with a remote. You can do it RF or IR control. The cost, I'm talking about something that's really like, for the power supply, the strip, and whatever version, you're spending like $15.
Yeah.
And you can tie multiple strips together and control them. Very simple wiring and termination and cutting.
Is it something you're thinking about doing for bias lighting around HDTVs?
That was the other thing for these TVs that are putting out, you know, over 1,000 nits.
Right.
You can't be staring at that in a pitch black room. So the ability to control a light on the back, and if you have fine enough control over the RGB, that allows you then to dial in a really, whatever shade you want, be it a color or a grayscale or whatever.
Right. We should point out bias lighting is essentially lighting that you place behind a TV, and what it does is reduces eye strain.
Totally.
Make the grays and the blacks on the screen.
Originally, it was used to kind of fool your eyes so you wouldn't perceive the bright dark black or the bright black levels on subpar TVs. And then that way, with that extra lighting around the edge, it made those grayish blacks look a little darker.
Right.
And it gave you the perception of greater contrast. So I was looking at for that. I was also just looking at it as an efficient lighting source for providing controllable colored lighting.
Right.
Foam stick back tape, waterproof, blah, blah, blah. You can cut it with a pair of scissors and terminate it with these cheap bag of clips. And
well, I mean,
I think it's a fun, inexpensive thing, but on top of it, there are some cool art style stuff. Like I'm really thinking about just outlining the back edge of my TV and then seeing how that can improve or not.
There are some
overall performance.
You can actually use like a Raspberry Pi or an Arduino to create an ambient lighting system like that.
Totally.
Say How To Geek had a good write-up on that.
Fully controllable devices. So if you've got any hand at all in being able to program a controller directly, oh, you're going to have a blast because then you can, you know, go nuts in terms of enabling dimming effects. That flashing mode you said, the RGB flashing in particular, is, I find it soothing, although it is really disrupting to a lot of people. Most people can't stare at that. It's like the staring into police headlights or flash bars or something. And it will either make you incredibly ill, have a seizure, or you just don't. Or you're like me, where it's like, it's just flashing light. It actually feels kind of soothing if I shove my face in it. I'm clearly an oddball in that case, but yeah. So, I'll put a link to that. But a 50-50 tape, actually, that's going to be like my holiday generic gift. I'm just going to get a bunch of those with the power supplies. Because you get like two packs of power supplies for a couple bucks.
Oh, that's cool.
Like I said, the strip cost me less than $10 for 15 plus feet, and that included the IR remote. The RF remote version was like a dollar more. It's pretty affordable, and yeah. I think anybody could get into it. There's really almost no way to harm yourself per se. I'm trying to think of ways
I could think of my 4-year-old staring at the LEDs at 2-centimeter ranges, yeah, and burning holes in his retinas. But
shouldn't do that.
That's just my children.
Protect the retina.
Protect the retina.
Also, too, but just a general warning: if you ever see anything in your vision ever change, like spots or a dot suddenly appear or something that wasn't there yesterday or the day before, please go to the optometrist.
Please.
Get that checked out.
Yes.
If it's if it's something that could be serious, it's so much better and so much easier and cheaper to deal with it quickly.
Yes.
And that's all I'll say. But protect those eyes. And
Eyeballs are
remind
important.
Everyone. Yeah. If something changes, there's something going on. Go get that looked at.
Yeah. And brush your teeth.
Yeah.
And go see the dentist at least once a year.
Try to floss. Get that gunk out of there.
Cardio.
Cardio's everything, man. Monitor caloric intake.
Yeah.
Drink more black coffee.
We're recording this a little later than usual, we're actually a little goofier than usual. I got a question. I want to find out if anybody's going to Cedia or the Rocky Mountain Audio Festival. I don't think I can pull Cedia together, but I think I'm going to try to hit the Rocky Mountain Audio Festival, go listen to some speakers and hear some more headphones and look at some other stuff.
I think you're going to see a few more of those 4K projectors showing up there, the value end of it.
Yeah.
So the DLP folks, I bet you show up with something.
I can't talk about them for a few days, but I saw a couple new projectors from a big projector manufacturer.
Excellent.
But we'll talk about those
more
in a couple weeks.
Freaking laser beams, more LEDs.
If you stuck with us this late in the podcast, you were obviously enthusiastic about AVXL, and we would like to invite you to help keep us making enough money to keep making this podcast for you. You can help support the podcast by going to patreon.com/AVXL. And help donate. We're going to do our first hangout next Thursday, people.
Woohoo!
Yeah, we're going to start doing hangouts next Thursday.
Oh, yeah. It's, I will be from a secret remote location, most likely. But
a secret location. So September 8th, ladies and gentlemen, put that on your map. Put that on your, if you're a patron of an appropriate level, we're going to contact you next Thursday, and we'll probably try to do a Saturday one in the near future too and get these rolling. So thank you, each and every one of you who sponsors us at AVXL. And hey, if you can't spend money or refuse to spend money on a podcast, I understand. If you could take a moment to review the podcast on iTunes, your favorite podcatcher, or forward a link to AVXL.com to one of your home theater /audio/home entertainment/weird dudes talking in the ether friends, we would greatly appreciate that. We want to grow the podcast and keep it going for you.
Yeah,
and
we do.
Seriously, thank
and
you so much for listening.
Appreciate you.
With that, ladies and gentlemen, I am at Patrick Norton.
I am at Robert Heron on Twitter. Yeah, yeah. Barbie.
And keep coming back and
please.
Send us those emails, ask@avxl.com. We'll see you next week.